Hello, this is Dr. Nalini Chilko, founder of the American Institute of Integrative Oncology Research and Education, and I'd like to welcome you to our monthly Grand Rounds call. These are really some of the most fun and enlivening parts of this program for me. This call will last approximately 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl, and then we'll move into case studies and questions from you. And we'll just want to be mindful of the patient privacy. If you bring up a question about a patient, remember that we don't want to associate any identifying information with them, either in your comments or in any documents you submit. And for right now, everyone is muted when you call in, and you would want to press *7 to unmute your line if you have a question or a comment, or you want to add to our discussion. And that's basically all you need to do. So we'll go ahead and start, and then I'll go through. So I'll start with the clinical pearl for this week. I'll go through a couple of questions that have been submitted, and then I will go ahead and discuss a case study that was submitted. So the clinical pearl that I want to bring to your attention this month is really the importance of following coagulation factors in your patients, whether they're well, whether they're undergoing treatment, or whether they are in recovery, because hypercoagulation and risk of thromboembolism is really kind of a fact of the landscape of cancer. And the reason for this is that tumor cells send out signals via a molecule called tissue factor that starts the entire clotting cascade, and I'll walk you through that briefly. And just to let you know, there's about 20 detailed slides that will come along with the handout for this call, so you can review this. I'm just going to give you the high altitude view because I often spend an hour or two teaching this, but I want to just bring it to the foreground so that you remember in clinical practice to track this in your patient, whether you're ordering the blood work yourself or you're asking one of your patient's physicians to do so. And one of the really interesting things about malignancy and coagulation is that in 1865, there was a Dr. Trousseau who actually observed that cancer patients had more clots in their blood and problems with stagnation in their circulation. And in traditional Chinese medicine, thousands of years ago, this is also an observation of the ancient Chinese physicians. And in fact, in Chinese medicine, cancer is called a condition of blood stasis. And a tumor is also thought as a condition of the qi and the blood not flowing and getting stuck. That's kind of their energetic understanding. But one of the reasons we track this is because when we see positive biomarkers of activated coagulation, then that is often and always correlated with elevated tumor markers, larger tumor mass, increased tumor burden, advanced disease, more angiogenesis and invasion into the stroma, more lymph node metastasis, definitely more aggressive disease. You'll often see this concurrent with increased inflammation systemically. This is really also a sign of disease progression. And so it can give you a sense of overall survival. And also sometimes it will reflect whether or not treatment has been successful. For example, I have a patient who's a triple negative breast cancer patient. And at the time of her diagnosis, she had a very high fibrinogen, very high CRP, an inflammatory marker, and very high D-dimer. And as she was successfully treated, those coagulation and inflammation markers went away and became more normal. So you can track either progress or progression in your patients. And also one of the reasons that we track this is because these patients have a sevenfold higher risk of having a thrombosis. And there's someone on the line who's not muted, and we can hear you wiggling around. So if you would kindly mute yourself until it's Q&A, that would be great. Thank you. These patients will have a higher risk of having a thromboembolic event. Patients actually have the hematologic malignancies. They have a 28-fold higher risk of having a thromboembolic event. And by that, we mean the leukemias and the myelomas and the lymphomas, the non-solid tumors. And patients who actually have more advanced disease with solid tumors who have distant metastases have a 20-fold higher risk of a venous thrombosis. So in that case, we see patients who really should not be having pulmonary embolisms and strokes and clots in their legs, et cetera. And so you want to watch your patients. I had one patient come in my office. She had a port in her arm. She's a stage 4 ovarian cancer patient, and she had a little chain of blood clots below her port. And since I see her more often than her oncologist, I was the one that observed it, and I had her sent over to the oncology office right away to be anticoagulated because that is life-threatening. And the placement of a port will also cause more risk of clots just by virtue of having a kind of a roadblock where the port is. And so this is really the second most common cause of death in cancer patients. So to have a patient who has cancer die not of their cancer, but of their cancer landscape and with something we could control, I think is very tragic. And so we can monitor and control this. If you're on the line on the call, could you please mute yourself? There's some background noise coming in, and when there's Q&A, you can unmute so we can talk to you. Thank you. So cancer cells will actually shed this factor called tumor factor, and they'll shed little microparticles, and that leads to this cascade of thrombin formation, which leads to fibrinogen formation, which leads to the development and production of fibrin, which is this really sticky protein that then can form like a little raincoat around by depositing itself around tumor cells, causing the tumor cell to become invisible to the immune system, but also blocking receptors for anything therapeutic, whether that is a conventional oncology treatment or one of our nutraceutical botanical treatments. If the agent can't get to the receptor, then we can't get a good therapeutic effect. And so these are some of the reasons that we want to decrease fibrosis and coagulation in our patients. And, you know, the main risk factors that increase risk is if a patient is an older patient. Women have a higher risk of clots than men. African Americans have a higher risk than Caucasians, being sedentary, of course, being a smoker, having more inflammation, being obese, insulin resistance, hypertension, a history of a thromboembolic event previously or a pulmonary embolism previously. So you want to be aware of other contributors to hypercoagulation in your patient. And the things that we take a look at, the biomarkers that you can track to see this landscape of hypercoagulation, you'll see if your leukocytes are over 11, and, you know, be aware if the patient just had Neupogen or Neulasta, then you have to understand that just might be an artifact of having that treatment recently. So you want to be clear where your biomarkers are coming from. Of course, if platelets are elevated above 350 is definitely a high risk, but you want to just watch trend in your patient, seeing markers of inflammation. If you track CRP, if you track interleukin-6 or interleukin-1 or TNF-alpha, you will see these elevated in a hypercoagulation-prone environment. Of course, always just the common things I track are fibrinogen activity and D-dimer and CRP. Those are the main things that I track. And then I look and see if the person in front of me has got insulin resistance, are they obese, are they sedentary? And then you usually do have a CBC to look at so you can take a look at your leukocytes and platelets. And so those are the main things. And remember that one biomarker or one data point is not useful by itself, but that trend is really what you want to be watching. So some of the interventions that I use are, again, some of the multitaskers so that we can accomplish many things in a treatment plan without giving a patient 30 different things. And so curcumin would fall into this category of platelet aggregation inhibitors. It, of course, changes the environment as well because it downregulates many inflammatory cytokines and has some antiangiogenic properties. So in this context, I would think about using curcumin 1 to 6 grams a day. And a person with very high tumor load, I would tip to that higher dose. Resveratrol also impacts thrombosis. It will reduce platelet aggregation and activation. And it also reduces the synthesis of some of the prothrombotic mediators. And it does decrease gene expression of tissue factor, which is this initiating event. Remember that a lot of our phytochemicals actually enter the nucleus and affect gene expression, and that's how they work. And a lot of these colorful phytochemicals, like curcumin being bright yellow and resveratrol being deep purple, these pigments also then tell you that they have some reactive oxygen species scavenging capacity, meaning that they have antioxidant function. And then the resveratrol directly will reduce fibrinogen and fibrinolysis because it inhibits tissue factor expression. And it also decreases plasma homocysteine, which is a contributor to a pro-coagulatory environment. And we can't forget omega-3 fatty acids. Let me tell you the dose of the resveratrol, between 1 and 5 grams a day, more typical 2 grams a day. Then the omega-3 fatty acids, of course, have a big impact on thrombosis as well as on inflammation. And so I'll use those anywhere from 2 to 6 grams a day. My typical dose there is 4 grams a day. And when we say omega-3 fatty acids, we primarily mean the omega-3 and omega-6. And then another big tool that I use is one of my absolutely favorite Chinese herbs, which is salvia miltiariza danshen, often called red sage. We use the root of this. And it is one of the most powerful antithrombotic, antifibrotic botanicals. And I'll often give this, even though I may be giving other botanicals or other formulas to a patient, I often give a patient an entirely separate bottle of red sage extract and have them have, you know, 1 to 3 teaspoons a day if they have a lot of fibrosis. For example, a lot of patients who have pelvic masses, ovarian and endometrial cancer patients, for example, or even sarcoma patients with abdominal and pelvic masses, they tend to have a lot of fibrosis. And so we can downregulate that with the salvia miltiariza. And so 1 to 3 grams a day if you're using the dry herb or the freeze-dried granules. And the active principles are the salvianoic acid, and there's an acetyl salvianoic acid, and the tansinones, as well as there's a cryptotansinone. And these not only impact the fibrosis and thrombosis and clotting factors, but the danshen has a lot of anti-tumor activity as well. It also will decrease some of the stickiness of the tumor cells and the endothelium, so you don't get adherence, which means it's not as easy for a metastatic cell to plant itself and grow a tumor mass in the new site. And the Salvia milcharize is a super antioxidant as well. It'll down-regulate thromboxanes and the COX-1 and 2 and some of the nitric acid enzymes as well. And it'll also inhibit some of the matrix metalloproteases, which means it inhibits invasion. And one of the more important pathways in tumor cell proliferation and growth signaling is the PI3K pathway. This is a tyrosine kinase pathway that is very involved in tumor growth and proliferation. It's involved in a lot of tumors. And if you look, for example, if you're ordering like a Keras or a Foundation One, you can see that these pathways are activated, and there are many, many botanicals that interfere, not only salvia, curcumin, hanokiol is a phytochemical that interferes in this pathway. So that there's a lot of studies also going on in conventional oncology looking how to inhibit this pathway. So you can see, as with our Materia Medica and our toolbox, when we have multitaskers, even just this one botanical with several phytochemicals and it addresses multiple genes and multiple pathways and multiple binding sites, and that is really truly the beauty of botanic medicine and molecules from nature. So just to summarize the big ideas, remember that the landscape of cancer, the tumor microenvironment, is often one of hypercoagulation. And I really recommend that you screen patients who are over 45, or even anybody who's younger, is obese and has diabetes, for example, for these coagulation risk factors and signs, so that you can really see trend over time. And remember that if you see this landscape of hypercoagulation, it might represent earliest signs of tumor activity. So you might be the first person to raise the question of whether or not we should do additional screening for a patient over time. And really make sure that you're monitoring patients who are in treatment for risk of thromboembolic events. And watch them closely and, you know, teach them that, you know, if they have a pain in their leg that persists in one spot, that, you know, they may have a small clot in the vein and they should notify their oncologist and go get an ultrasound to see if that's what it is. And, you know, teach them not to be sedentary. If you have a patient undergoing treatment who has to take a long plane trip, then you want to make sure they stay hydrated, get up and walk around on the plane. Maybe you want to give them a little extra curcumin, extra omega-3 fatty acids to oppose platelet aggregation a bit while they're on a long plane ride. Just really teach the patient what to pay attention to. And remember that the population of patients also who live with cancer as a chronic illness is an at-risk population. And we should really be watching their physiology to look again for trend. Are they stable? Are they moving away from so much cancer activity? Or do we see signs of microscopic activity in their blood? And so we really want to monitor these patients. And then you don't want to forget your patients who are in remission and have no evidence of disease, because we want to be watching the landscape to also watch trend to see if they are moving in a direction where we want to raise other questions. So those are mainly the big ideas, to the high altitude kind of summary ideas. And I do have a set of slides for you to review details. There are references on all those slides. And then I just want to close this little pearl here by stating that the Mediterranean diet is an antithrombotic diet. So that not only is great for producing a tumor microenvironment that controls many factors that contribute to proliferation and metastasis and carcinogenesis, but of course, you know, a lot of other things like cardiovascular disease and diabetes are inhibited by this diet. And so we want to teach patients how to eat and remind them. I'm actually thinking about bringing a coach into my practice to do a lot more patient teaching on this, because I really don't have time to. And so you might think about if you don't have a coach or have time for a coach, you might want to think about using technology and making little mini videos for your patients to watch. If you don't have time to teach them these things, or have a coach that has a little kind of a curriculum that teaches the patient about all of these things. I have my little book that I wrote a couple years ago called 32 Ways to Outsmart Cancer that kind of goes through all of these things, so I don't have to repeat myself over and over again. So I think part of our job is not only to be knowledgeable, but to understand how to educate patients well and how to help them implement and keep reviewing, because when they're in our offices, they're often very stressed. And when you have high cortisol, you don't remember a thing anybody said to you. So we need ways to keep putting this information in front of our patients in a way they can digest it and utilize it. So I'm going to just pause here. If anybody has a question about this topic, I'll take some questions on it now before I move on to some questions that were submitted. So if you have a question about this topic, you can unmute yourself and let us know. Okay, I will move on. You'll have another opportunity to ask questions a little bit later. So I have to say that Judy Pruszynski is the rock star of submitting cases and questions, and they are super good questions. And I also have to say that in having cases submitted, I feel so absolutely wonderfully excited to see that you are learning how to do this, and that I actually am able to pass on this approach and build your skills and knowledge. It was very exciting for me to look at treatment plans that really show that you're gaining knowledge and skill. And that just has so much meaning to me, because that's why I'm doing this in the first place. So let me answer a couple of questions. So one of the questions was about a supplement called Inflammatone. Judy says, you know, it's one of my favorite formulas, Inflammatone. This happens to be a Designs for Health formulation. She says, I love its botanical components, but also the level of proteolytic enzymes. I prescribe it for many different forms of inflammation, usually suggesting 4 to 5 capsules at night on an empty stomach. Question, is it appropriate to take long-term as a maintenance against inflammation, infection, or a kind of as a systemic treatment, or is it better to take a break from it, or only take it when inflammation is a known condition? So really great multi-layered question. So first of all, let's just look at what's in it. I actually printed out the formula for you on the notes, so you'll have that to look at. But it's very high in proteolytic enzymes. And there is a tradition in cancer care of giving high doses of proteolytic enzymes to cancer patients. And there are many reasons. The rationale for this is to inhibit hypercoagulation, number one. But number two, you do see a decrease in some of the COX-1 and 2 and LOX enzymes with proteolytic enzymes. And so I like this formula for that reason as well. This formula also contains turmeric and boswellia, turmeric being the source of curcumin, boswellia being the source of boswellic acids, and ginger being a source of gingerols primarily in this case. And so all three of those phytochemicals and botanicals have anti-inflammatory activity, but they can work on different pathways. This little list of three phytochemicals and botanicals would address the COX-1 and 2, as well as the LOX-5, and it would dial down TNF-alpha and NF-kappa-B, and also the prostaglandins, the inflammatory prostaglandins like PGE2 and thromboxane A2. So this is a super duper anti-inflammatory. And then this formula has added to it a little bit of quercetin, a little bit of rutin, some rosemary, and a little bit of resveratrol. So these are in fairly small doses. And this formula was actually originally created as a musculoskeletal anti-inflammatory formula, and was primarily targeted towards clinicians that were chiropractors and orthopedists adults and dealing with people with musculoskeletal soft tissue injuries, and also patients with inflammatory diseases like arthritis or acute tendinitis, etc. And so when I first saw this formula, I went, wow, this is a great anti-cancer formula to really affect the tumor microenvironment. So the way that I use it is also multi-layered. I will use it as a core piece of a plan for a cancer patient or a cancer survivor, and I will use it long-term. And it really depends on the inflammation level of the patient. So I am usually tracking CRP and, just sort of following my patient closely as well. And so I often will give either four times a day, up to four times a day. So you have to just see how inflamed someone is. Some patients don't tolerate super high doses of curcumin. And if you have a patient like that, you need to take note of it. If you want to go to the higher doses, you might want to stair step them up. But remember that nutraceuticals and botanicals have a very short half-life in the blood. And if somebody has really acute inflammation or pain, then you have to dose them frequently. They can't just take it once in the morning or 12 hours apart and get a good management of pain and inflammation. A patient who has cardiovascular disease would also do well on this supplement. And so those patients, I might dose twice a day for chronic long-term use. If a person has an active infection, I might go up to the four times a day for 3 to 5 days. In the context of a patient with active cancer, advanced disease, I might go up to three or four times a day. And I might do this for many months at a time and then drop it down to a maintenance dose of two to three times a day. Again, it depends where the patient's baseline is. If they're also a patient who has autoimmune disease, also a patient has low-grade inflammation, if they have other contributors to inflammation, then you might have a patient who needs more aggressive control. But I don't see any contraindication for using it on a daily basis long-term. I actually use it on a daily basis twice a day just for health. I don't have any inflammatory issues except for being in my 60s, so I want to keep my inflammation down. This is a great formula for also the brain, because both curcumin and resveratrol cross the blood-brain barrier. And so I love this formula for a wide spectrum of uses. And if you have access to the Designs for Health website, then you can see their data sheet, their tech sheet with all of their references on it as well. And we could even post it in here if people want, but it's on their website. And it's really a truly synergistic formula. And it has a very, very long safety record. It's one of the original formulas that was designed actually by Linda Lazat, who was a brilliant, brilliant nutritionist and herbalist, who was one of the founders of the company and the developers of a lot of their early formulas like this one. So I will also pause here. If anyone has any questions about this formula, I will pause and you can unmute yourself and ask. Okay. And, remember, you can submit questions off the call as well, and we'll address them. If you can't attend the call live, you're always welcome to submit your questions and your cases ahead of time, and I will still review them, whether you're on the call or not. So don't feel that if your time zone or your responsibilities do not allow you to be on the call, then you can still answer your questions, and I will address them. Now, we have another question that's kind of a follow-up from the last call, in which I was talking about the estrobilome, the impact of the microbiome on a patient's lifetime exposure to estrogen due to hepatic recirculation. If you have high amounts of the enzyme beta-glucuronidase in your gut, then you get a deconjugation of the conjugated estrogen that comes into the gut, and then you get a recirculation of the estrogen back into the general circulation. So the question was, like, what's a normal level of beta-glucuronidase in the stool? And I have to tell you, I searched and searched and searched for the labs on the labs websites that measure this, who do the functional medicine stool test. I did not see a normal value anywhere. I'm going to keep looking. I'm actually going to call the lab because I couldn't find the answer to this question. But what I did do is I copied and pasted information from Genova Diagnostics' discussion of beta-glucuronidase, which covers things that are relevant to the digestive tract and to colon cancer, which I didn't discuss. My discussion was really related to estrogen metabolism and beta-glucuronidase, but it is worth noting that beta-glucuronidase has other functions also. And so it has the ability to also affect the conjugation and metabolism of vitamin D, other toxins that are xenoestrogens, and some phytonutrients. So we wouldn't want to have too low an amount of beta-glucuronidase because it does have some healthy functions, but we certainly get into trouble when we have excess amounts. And so what promotes a more normal ratio of beta-glucuronidase in the gut, I can speak to that, which is if you have more lactobacillus and bifidus species and less bacterioides and less clostridium species, then you will have more normal levels of beta-glucuronidase, and you will certainly not have excess levels of it. And so you can read this really, really quite thorough discussion of beta-glucuronidase in relationship to colon health and other metabolic issues that I have included for you in the notes. And also, I discovered as I was doing extra research on this that one of our very, very famous long-term, centuries-old Chinese herbal formulas actually reduces beta-glucuronidase. So I want to teach you a little bit about that formula. So this formula is called Modified Six Gentlemen Formula. There's a very famous formula called Four Gentlemen Formula. It's based on four herbs, which I have listed for you all the notes for this as well. But the main herb is ginseng, Panax ginseng. And in the less expensive forms of this, another herb, Dangshan, D-A-N-G-S-H-E-N, is used. It's Codonopsis. It's kind of milder than the more expensive ginseng, but it tonifies the qi of the spleen. And what we mean by that is that it helps promote normal digestion, absorption, normal peristalsis, and normal elimination. And there are three other herbs that are form this core base formula, Fu Ling or Poria, which is also a spleen qi tonic, but also has some anti-tumor activity because it's rich in beta-glucans and polysaccharides because it is a fungus. And Baishu, Atractolodes alba, is also tonifies the qi of the spleen, meaning it supports digestion, normal peristalsis, normal microbiome. But it also is a mild diuretic. And then baked licorice root, which is a harmonizer for many formulas in traditional Chinese medicine, but it also tonifies the qi, and it's said to balance formulas. So that's your core formula. The tradition of Chinese herbal medicine in formulas often takes these core formulas that have a very important function. And so the digestion, of course, fixing the digestion is core to naturopathic medicine and functional medicine as well. And to then modify these formulas to make them tip in a direction therapeutically. So Six Gentlemen adds two other herbs, Pinellia or Bansha. And this is a botanical that really helps to dissolve thick secretions and the Chinese call that phlegm, but it really applies to very thick mucus-like secretions that are produced by the epithelia. That could be respiratory, it could be GI. And then also 10P, which is citrus peel, dried citrus peel, which is one of the great digestives. In California, we have so much citrus that when I get organic tangerines, I actually dry the peels and I use it in cooking to make food more digestible. So you can put it in soup or rice or sauces, and it gives a very nice light taste as well. You can throw some in a shake. So this is a very mild herb, but it makes this for general and formula extremely digestive and to kind of not have sluggish digestion. And then the modified aromatic or fragrant formula that is referred to in this study that showed that this formula decreases beta-glucuronidase adds two very aromatic herbs. It adds shauran, which is cardamom. And it also adds an herb called musang, which certain different herbs have been used traditionally, but mostly an herb called sarsaparilla. But these are herbs that concentrate these very, very aromatic, pungent oils. And almost all herbs that are culinary herbs have some kind of a aromatic oil. You know, think about using ginger, think about oregano, thyme, dill, all of the herbs, mint, that have any kind of aromatic oil. And these tend to be terpenes, and they're very light. So when you cook food that has these in it, you want to cover it or put them in right at the end so they don't all just evaporate into the air. They're very light oils. And so, for example, if you want to make a medicinal tea, say out of mint, then you would cover it and steep it for 20 minutes to get medicine as opposed to beverage tea. And you would keep it covered so the aromatic oils and the volatile oils didn't evaporate into the air but stayed in the water. So by adding these aromatics, these herbs fall into the category of carminatives, which are herbs that have aromatic oils that improve peristalsis and help with passing gas and flatulence. But some of them also relax the lining of the gut and help people who have cramps and pain due to that. So this formula is based on phlogiston, and then it adds these digestives and aromatic carminative herbs. And this formula is also an agent that not only really enhances our digestive function, but also like gastric emptying and the fall of peristalsis and the ability to eliminate. So the profile of a patient for whom this is a good formula is someone who does not just digest their food well, that gets a lot of food reactions, that has a lot of gas and bloating. And so then on top of that, you get this ability to decrease your beta-glucuronidase. And so this is one of the classic formulas of Chinese medicine. So if you are interested in Chinese medicine, you only want to learn a handful of formulas, this is one you should know about, because helping digestion is such a big part of our practices in general. And so that is, I think, where I'll stop on that so I can get to a case study. And but I will pause if anyone has any questions about beta-glucuronidase or this Chinese herb formula. Okie dokie. So let's go on to Judy's case study. So let me find it here. Hold on. Where'd my notes go? Okay, here it is. All right. So this is a great case with really good questions. This is a 59-year-old female Caucasian woman. The body type is short and slightly round, and that's kind of what somebody looks like if they have a spleen qi imbalance in Chinese medicine, or if they're just an earth type body and they're more stocky and sturdy and compact. And this woman wants to do everything possible to stay healthy and not have a recurrence of her breast cancer. and live from a more functional level and or accept the level of function she has. Well, let's try and give her better function. So these are the things that are important to her. And remember, my emphasis in your patient relationships is always to find out first, ask first what is important to the patient, not only because that will help you design a program that will they'll engage in more, but it makes people feel seen and heard if you really get it. Then let's see, her primary diagnosis is breast cancer, a left-sided breast cancer, a T3N1MO BRCA positive grade 3. So she had a fairly large mass being T3. She had one positive lymph node, no metastases, but she has a BRCA 1 mutation. And she had a grade 3, so an active, more rapidly metabolizing, more rapidly dividing cells, also evidenced by her Ki-67 greater than 45. And what some notes here that are quite interesting is that she had two tumors and one lymph node, which were triple negative. Her two negative ER, and then an MRI found a third tumor, which was different. It was her two negative, but ER positive and PR positive. So this is worthy of our discussion here because this is an example that of the heterogeneous nature of tumor cells, and that not every tumor in a person's body, if they have more than one site, will be exactly the same animal. And so that's often why treatments fail, is because all the cells aren't the same. And so this is important to know. And then as most likely a pretty meticulous physician, surgeon, and pathologist that really identified this. So then we need to think more broadly about this because she's both triple negative, ER positive, PR positive, and BRCA1 mutation. So all of those things have to go into our thinking. In terms of her current status, she has removed sugar and Diet Cokes. She has poorly controlled diabetes, huge risk for progression, so we'd want to get a handle on that. She does not sleep well, also risk for her immunity and risk for obesity, risk for control of her blood sugar, and she does not have a good support system. She has a very, very stressful family life, so that also means then that she may have high cortisol a lot of the time. That might be why she doesn't sleep well, because home is not safe or a sanctuary. I just had a conversation with a newly diagnosed stage 4 lung cancer patient. Her husband accompanied her, and they had a fight in my office. And I just stopped them, and I said, you have to stop that. You have to wish your partner ease. You know, this is really hard, and no one has the coping skills for it when you're first diagnosed, and so you have to be kind to each other. And that was not the state of their marriage. So I spent a lot of time just doing like couples counseling with them, just asking them not to interrupt each other, to listen to each other, to be kind and respectful towards each other, which was not their style. And they'd been married a long time. So this, of course, brings up everybody's fears and often the worst sides of ourselves when we're frightened. So, but it's also an opportunity to transform and open our hearts and step up and do better. So, this woman, she tries to be gluten-free and dairy-free, and she's doing bone broth, so getting her food choices better. Maybe she needs more coaching there. And then she suffered during her treatment. She suffered from bone pain, mouth sores, hemorrhoids, nausea, did some cannabis for that, and had a lot of inflammation. She has lymphedema, neuropathy, swelling and numbness in her lower legs and feet, which continues. And one of her primary concerns is the unresolved neuropathy, according to my understanding of this. And let's see what else is doing, and then I'll give you my comments. So let's talk about the neuropathy. And also there's a comment here that when she's off her aromatase inhibitor letrozole, that she has less neuropathy. So I'll just say that's not really so common. And so women typically have much less joint pain when they're off of their aromatase inhibitors. Not my experience that neuropathy is a adverse effect of aromatase inhibitors. So this patient maybe just has so much pain she can't subjectively differentiate what is neuropathy and what is joint pain. It just might be she's that uncomfortable and it all blends together. But nevertheless, if a patient feels better when she goes off an aromatase inhibitor, then I suggest one of several things. So let's talk about that. But just for people who don't know what an aromatase inhibitor is, when a woman has estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, that means that she has estrogen-driven cancer cells. And a strategy to reduce risk of recurrence or even to treat these cancers, some of these women don't get chemotherapy at all, but just get aromatase inhibitors and their tumors shrink because you starve them out of estrogen. So after successful treatment, then oftentimes a course of aromatase inhibitors is given if the woman is postmenopausal, only if the woman is postmenopausal. And this reduces the production of aromatase enzyme in the breast tissue. And this is where androgens are turned into estrogens in the breast tissue in the presence of aromatase enzyme. And so by inhibiting that conversion, then you take away some of the estrogen in the tissue and you starve out a growth signal, a major growth signal, and then any tumor cells that rely upon that for proliferation don't have that growth signal. And remember, everyone who's had treatment, even a stage one patient who just had a lumpectomy, they have micrometastases. And so that's why they should all come see us so that we can help them create a tumor microenvironment and a physiology that is going to be inhibitory and not supportive of any growth signaling. And so one of the questions that Judy asks here also is, how long do you continue this sort of treatment with nutraceuticals, et cetera? And I really, my answer to this is for the rest of their life. They need to take control of this because there are microscopic cells left. And if they never, ever do anything, then they will never have cells that grow into a tumor. And so that's our job, really. When the tumor mass has been reduced, the tumor burden has been reduced, and then the oncologist is not likely to do much except perhaps something like tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. But in many cancers, after treatment with conventional oncology, then being surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormonal therapy, now things like tyrosine kinase inhibitors and monoclonal antibodies. But when those courses of treatment are finished, then the oncologist just, you know, cuts the patient loose. But that, those patients, every single patient who's ever had any stage of cancer should be doing something to change the landscape so that it is, you know, the language we use with patients is so that you create a body in which cancer cannot thrive. You create a body that is not supportive of any of these growth signals and, in fact, has control signals. And instead of signaling and turning on oncogenes, keeps them turned off and promotes tumor suppressor genes, controls inflammation, optimizes vitamin D. I mean, there's no end to doing that. And remember that when we look at all those factors, if we optimize insulin control and glycemic control and insulin expression, then we also reduce risk of diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, brain aging, et cetera. So this is just a health plan for a person. So then it really depends on the motivation and on the budget of the person. So at least we want to have effectively changed the diet and lifestyle of the person. But there's a minimum of supplements that I would really like someone to take long term. And so that would include a multivitamin that was copper-free and iron-free. If you had a menstruating woman, then you would look at her appropriate need for iron, keep it in the lowest quartile of normal. Always put a probiotic in, always put vitamin D in, and women put in bone minerals and omega fatty acids. that's kind of the core for just general health for all of my patients. Then on top of that, for someone with a cancer history, then I'll think about putting in some curcumin and some resveratrol and some sulforaphanes and some Chinese mushrooms. And that's sort of my minimum cocktail for patients who have a cancer history. If they can afford to do that long term, we could think of lots of other things we could put in and add in. And so, and I do with patients who have the budget for it, and make it even a more aggressive anti-tumor longevity kind of a formula. But the answer to your question is I do all of those things long term. I encourage patients to start with a health plan and continue their health plan. So if they come in my office at the beginning of diagnosis, then I start putting those foundations of health right into their plan. When they're undergoing treatment, we manage the adverse effects. We might also want to enhance the effects of their other treatments by putting some, tumor cytotoxic botanicals into their protocols. We may at times want to, if they have a high burden of toxins, do special things if they need their gut corrected and their microbiome normalized and optimized. You know, we might have some work to do, but the answer to your question is it's in an ideal world, those 9 supplements are what I want everyone to take long term to have the best of health. So I also see that she's on gabapentin, and that's the conventional solution to chronic neuropathy. It doesn't work very well in most people. So here's what I do for neuropathy. It is my feeling that ongoing neuropathy in a patient is really a redox cycle that hasn't been quenched, meaning that the body is not able to scavenge all of the rogue electrons, reactive oxygen species that were triggered by a pro-oxidative treatment. That might be a platinum drug, that might be radiotherapy, for example. And of course, the environment and territory of inflammation is one filled with oxidative stress. So I look at chronic, ongoing, unresolved neuropathies, and you know, people can have neuropathies for years, 8-10 years after they have had successful treatment. And so you want to quench that oxidative stress. You have to look at their diet, make sure it has enough color in it so that there is enough plant antioxidants. And if you don't think a patient will eat enough servings of fruits and vegetables every day, like 8 to 12 servings a day, then you can throw in some reds powders or greens powders, which are concentrates of plants that are filled with their plant pigments and phytochemicals as a strategy. Remember, all of those pigments also turn off a lot of oncogenes, and so that's useful, and also turn off some of the inflammatory signaling as well. So that's one thing. I did have a patient with chronic neuropathy post-platinum treatment that was a chain smoker, and I just said, well, we're not going to resolve your neuropathy if we have all that oxidative stress going on all the time. I always find it paradoxical to have a patient in my office who keeps smoking, but you know, we're all irrational and addiction is addiction. So actually she cut down her smoking significantly. Acupuncture is fabulous for neuropathies and neurologic disorders in general. And so I generally will do a course of treatment. If the neuropathy is very bad, twice a week. If it's not too bad, I'll do it once a week, and I usually do a 3-month course of treatment. And then I will add omega fatty acids, usually at some fairly high doses, so that we're also nourishing the nerve sheath, the fatty myelin covering of nerve axons, and 2 to 4 grams a day in most people. And then I'll look at other anti-inflammatory formulas. So we could consider Inflammatone in this case. We could just consider adding some curcumin, for example. I often put the herb Feverfew, tenacetum, in some of my patients' formulas. It's not only got a lot of anti-proliferative activity and a lot of good studies on it, but I also then will put in I'll put the feverfew in just as an anti-inflammatory. But I like to look at things that are multitaskers. I like Boswellia also as an anti-inflammatory. And remember that the medicinal mushrooms, the things like Coriolis and Ganoderma and Cordyceps also have anti-inflammatory activity. You would want this person to also remove any triggers of inflammation, such as cigarettes, but also any foods that were pro-inflammatory. So we just want to take all the triggers of inflammation. We want to downgrade the oxidative stress and provide an environment in which that stress could be quenched. So that might be adding N-acetylcysteine, which is the precursor to glutathione. And so glutathione, remember, is our body's own intracellular super antioxidant. You could do like 800 or 900 milligrams three times a day of that. And then alpha-lipoic acid, which is an antioxidant, which works both in water-soluble and fat-soluble spaces. So it's hydrophilic and lipophilic, so it works in many compartments. And so we think about the nerve having a fatty sheath and want to get some antioxidants there. I use the stabilized R-lipoic acid because that's the biologically active form. So if you just buy alpha-lipoic acid, you're getting both the R and the L racemic mixture. It's less expensive, but it's also less effective. And you can give 100 milligrams of that, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 times a day, depending how bad the neuropathy is. And then one of my favorite things is acetyl L-carnitine, not to be confused with L-carnitine, which acts mostly in the mitochondria and the muscle, but the acetyl L-carnitine is active in the neuron. It's useful in neuropathies. It is also useful for what we call chemo brain or chemotherapy-related cognitive impairment. Very good for that. And I'll give that in about 1.5 to 2 grams a day. And glutamine is also effective for nerve repair. And of course, glutamine is a little bit controversial in the oncology community because we know that certain tumor cells will use glutamine for fuel instead of glucose. But some of the people I respect the most, including Donnie Yance and Paul Anderson, who are really brilliant in the naturopathic oncology community, as well as Dr. Dwight McKee, one of my mentors, medical doctor, integrative oncologist, all feel that, you know, the body makes its own glutamine. There's no such thing as a low glutamine environment, really. So the feeling is that doing some glutamine therapeutically doesn't really cause increased proliferation. So I will use it for a short period of time to either repair the lining of the gut. Remember that colonocytes use glutamine as their primary fuel. So if you have a patient on a chemotherapy agent or even some of the tyrosine kinase agents like erlotinib, Tarceva will cause a sloughing off of the epithelial linings and coverings. That's why you get some of the skin symptoms in those drugs as well. Then you want to repair that epithelium, and glutamine is really great for that. Also, the bone broth this woman is drinking is really great for, you know, density of nutrients and protein. A cup of traditionally made bone broth has 10 grams of protein in it. So these are all the things that we need for repair. And so the principles of treating neuropathy, chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, are to reduce oxidative stress, to promote the body's oxidation, antioxidant, reactive oxygen species scavenging capacity, and to provide the nutrients for healthy nerve and healthy nerve sheath. So a protocol like this, I'll generally do for anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks, including a course of acupuncture, and then see where we're at. Do we need to continue it or do we have resolution? We all know that we get better outcomes with patients who are more highly compliant. So I had a patient who had long-term neuropathy who came to me for that purpose, was in a lot of pain for many years. And we did this exact protocol on her, and it completely resolved her neuropathy. which had been persistent for over 5 years. After she completed treatment, she was also on gabapentin, which really doesn't work very well, but that's the main idea that oncologists have. So that's a very effective treatment and protocol. And so I think for this woman, I also would help her, to find ways to manage her stress so that she has lower cortisol, can sleep better, and isn't, have down regulating her immunity because of all the stress. Also, of course, all that stress, is a fat storage physiology as well, because, it may be that she's going to stay in her family or marriage and just needs to get better at coping and maybe even advise some family therapy because for the long term, she can't be in an environment like that if it can be transformed and healed. So I think those are my main points for this case, and I will open it up to questions.
Hi, I'm finally unmuted. I've tried forever.
Okay, who Judy. Is that?
It's Judy. Hi, thanks so much. So I don't have questions with you, what you just said. That's great. Just a little aside, I didn't say she was BRCA1 mutation.
Oh.
And I think that all of that was in the margin that you give.
Oh, okay, I see. Great. Got it. I got it.
But that wouldn't change anything you said, though, right?
Well, it would because, and I didn't address it, so thanks for bringing it up. Okay, so I was reading my examples, not your notes. Got it. So so if this woman was BRCA positive, then remember that the BRCA mutations are DNA repair problems. And so we would advise a woman who is BRCA positive or a man who is BRCA positive to avoid exposure to radiation. Why would we say that? Because radiation damages DNA. And so if you can't repair your DNA, then radiation exposure becomes a bigger risk for cancer from radiation exposure than a person who doesn't have that mutation. So we don't want those patients who are BRCA positive to have x-rays or radiotherapy or mammograms if there's another diagnostic choice for them or another treatment choice for them. So that would be one thing I would say differently. And the other thing is I would say that niacinamide, not to be confused with niacin, which is nicotinamide, niacinamide is a PARP inhibitor, and the PARP inhibitor drugs address some of the metabolic factors that are involved in BRCA mutations and give a lot of protection to women. And the dose of about 2 grams a day is therapeutic for these patients. The niacinamide does not cause a flush. And Douglas Labs is the only company I know that makes it in a high dose capsule of 500 milligrams. So I do put BRCA positive patients on, like 1,000 milligrams of niacinamide twice a day. And so to give them some protection in that way. So that's what I would say differently about that.
Great. And I do have one question going back to when you were talking about the curcumin and the inflammatone.
Yeah.
What do you feel about the statement that curcumin is only activated when in the presence of black pepper? How important do you find that? Have you found that in the studies?
Well, I think it's more important for curcumin to be given with something fatty. And so you'll see these lipolyzed capsules now, and or you can look at traditional Indian foods always with some ghee or some coconut oil, so that could be their omega-3 fatty acid. But I like to use the products where the capsules have some emulsification with a fat, and I actually think that certainly studies show that black pepper and piperine are helpful But I just think that is enhancing digestion. And so if the patient is eating food that has a lot of spices in it, I think that's probably sufficient. But remember that most, the standard American diet, there's no spices. It's really bland. Some English food is pretty bland also. So it kind of depends what the person eats. So I think it's also fine to just say, add some ginger to your food, add some black pepper to your food when you're taking your supplements. I think it's really mostly impacting digestive function. And I have said this before, but I think it's worthy of reflection. And that is Dr. Bharat Agarwal, who is one of the primary researchers and experts in curcumin in the world, used to be at MD Anderson. And I heard him say one time that feeling that curcumin is not absorbable, and that's why you don't see it in the bloodstream in high amounts after a person ingests it. He said that he thinks that it may be so that curcumin is so highly absorbable and that it's so readily taken up by the cells, that's why you don't see it in the blood. So I think, you know, it remains to be seen. But if we always, I always go back to looking at how things are used traditionally, right? So in India, for example, and also in Southeast Asia, where curcumin is a large part of the diet, and it's always with coconut oil or ghee or sesame oil. And those populations have, for example, lower occurrence of Alzheimer's disease, for example. And we know curcumin crosses the blood-brain barrier. And so we could assume that the small dietary amounts are part of a contribution to a large population having lower risk of certain things that are common in the West. So it's thought that the high amount of curcumin in the diet in India contributes to better brain health. And so we don't know for certain, but I feel strongly that having people use curcumin, take a curcumin supplement with in an oil a based capsule is probably more important than the piperine.
So then that brings up another question for me. That makes total sense, and that's food. And I, if we're taking the inflammatone has got the proteolytic enzymes, which you have to have away from food. So would you separate out and do the curcumin with fats and do the proteolytic enzymes on their own at another time?
So if we're using inflammatone for strictly for inflammation, then you get a better effect when you take it on an empty stomach or, you know, before a meal, let it, you know, 20 minutes before a meal, before you put food in there, because then the proteolytic enzymes are acting as anti-inflammatories. Even they can act as a substitute for Advil and Aleve in some patients at high doses. Or if you're just using proteolytic enzymes by themselves and you're using them for inflammation, then you want to definitely take them on an empty stomach. You get a lot more mileage out of it. If you take it with food, particularly a high protein meal, then you're going to get great digestion from it, right? So if you want to, like Nicholas Gonzalez was a famous integrative oncologist who died last year, and he used super high doses of proteolytic enzymes like Wobenzyme, like 20 capsules, you know, twice a day, you know, spread out over the day. That is a tradition in integrative oncology that works in some solid tumors. And it was done in Germany for a long time. And there are clinicians that still do that. All that is done on an empty stomach. And so, I think in a synergistic formula like inflammatone, you're still going to get benefit out of the formula, even if a patient doesn't take it perfectly, you know. And so you instruct the patient the best you can, but inflammatone is a worthwhile formula, even if it's not taken on an empty stomach.
Great. And last question then is, would the Wobenzyme be the proteolytic enzyme formula you would go to if you just wanted to do proteolytic enzymes on their own?
No, it's really super expensive. And so there's actually some copycat formulas which basically have high amounts of proteolytic enzymes plus rutin plus quercetin. So you can see that inflammatome is trying to copy that part of Wobenzyme. But there are copycat formulas made by nutraceutical companies here that are much less expensive than Wobenzyme. So for those, gosh, I'm just blocking on the name. I know that Enzymatic Formulas and Integrative Therapeutics has one. That's a copycat. I can't remember the name of it. But it's just proteolytic enzymes and rutin and quercetin. And so then that's a good substitute if people want to go down that route. But I tend not to include these super, super high doses of proteolytic enzymes because there's only so many pills you can ask somebody to take. And I want patients to take some other things in high doses. So it's not my style, but it definitely works. You know, definitely works in solid tumors. Hello? Are you still there?
Oh, I muted myself again. So thank you very much. I'm good.
Okay. So that brings us a little bit over an hour. If there are any other questions, you can unmute yourself and raise your hand. And I'll pause for a moment. All right. So thank you so much for your energy, attention, and interest. I'm going to close now. And I want to pose a question to you and invite you to give me some feedback about whether or not you'd like to have a private Facebook group for this group of students in our community. If you think it would be of significant value to you, where you could also talk to each other, pose questions, talk about your patients together, if you would engage in that type of a resource, then we're thinking about doing it. And so we'll send you out by email, we'll send you a little poll and you can give us some input or other ideas because I really, really want to hear your feedback about how you're experiencing the course and what else would add value. And I want to remind you that you can submit a question or a case study at any time during the month. Our next call will be on the 12th of July. And so you just go log into the course, go to the Grand Rounds page. If you scroll down a little bit, you'll see a button that says submit a question, submit a case, and you can do that any time during the month. Giving me a little lead time helps me prepare well for you. And so I look forward to next time with all of you. And let us know how we can support you and make this course better and add more value. Thank you and good night.